LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hello, folks. I want to welcome you to Labor Relations Information Systems November 2015 podcast, our first Thursday podcast, where once a month we review things that have been going on in the news about public safety labor relations issues. The first thing I want to do is actually recap a couple of things that we've done over the last month that may be of interest to you. We've done some podcasts in between our first Thursday podcast. We've done some podcasts on very specialized issues. We also have a series of interviews with people out there in the news in public safety labor issues. I want to point you to a couple of those podcasts if you are facing the sorts of issues that we addressed. The first is one that dealt with the labor relations impact of body cameras. In that podcast, basically what we do is to say, look, people tend to be rushing to setting up body camera policies. We really need to be a lot more thoughtful about what we're doing in the area. And here are the issues you ought to think about. Issues that range from when's the camera turned on and when is the camera turned off to what sort of disciplinary use can be made of body camera issues, to who owns the data, all sorts of issues that really you need to address before, not after, you put your body camera policy into place. The second podcast I'd like to direct your attention to is one that deals with the communicable disease policies of public safety agencies. We learned a lot from the Dallas experience, both from the firefighter, the EMS, and the police officer basis. We learned a lot about what we don't have in place. We don't have really good policies that are going to deal with a large-scale outbreak of communicable diseases and what that means in terms of the response by public sector agencies. To be sure, Ebola doesn't look like it is going to be the large-scale outbreak that some had feared. It doesn't seem to be as communicable a disease as would need be to get a widespread outbreak, at least in this country. But there's other diseases, as you know, that are waiting in the wings, and in particular diseases like antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis and the like. It's important to have policies in place so that employees and employers understand the obligations and rights of everybody who's concerned. Whether it be whose orders do you have to follow? What if the Centers for Disease Control gets involved in the process? How does that disrupt or does it disrupt the chain of command? Questions such as who's going to be responding to outbreaks or to a containment situation? Is it going to be sort of a specialized team? Think of it as a medical, to borrow a law enforcement analogy, a medical SWAT team, all the way to issues concerning workplace safety, premium pay, extra life insurance and disability insurance and the like. If you're facing either of these issues, the issue of body cameras or communicable disease issues, we recommend you go back to our podcasts. They're online in our podcast library. Listen to them. If you have comments, send your comments in. We're glad to update those, and we're just trying to get the information out, get the policy issues out as best as we can. And then you do with those policy issues what you will in terms of how you resolve issues. Before I get into the month's podcast proper, I thought I'd take a moment and review where we are in terms of the public safety negotiations for the big three cities in the country. And that would be New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And we're sort of in an interesting place in all three cities. In New York, the situation I think has to be characterized from either management or labor side as either not good or bad. The police and firefighters, and there's a variety of unions on the police side, a rank and file unit, a sergeant's unit, a detective's unit, there's a variety of different units. All of those contracts expired in 2010. They're all working under an expired contract. Negotiations, at least for the rank and file police, the 23,000 member Patrolman's Benevolent Association of New York, they are at impasse. There seems to be fights going on in the impasse process. And there's also some very public positions being taken by New York's new mayor and by some of the police unions, not about bargaining issues, but about the whole stop and frisk issue that seem to be sort of slopping over in terms of the relationship that anybody can expect over on the bargaining side. So the news from New York is not a good situation, never a good situation to have an expired contract, but particularly not a good situation to have a contract that's been expired by 4 years. Chicago, a little bit different situation, very different situation, and actually for the first time in many, many years, we've got some stability. Earlier this year, the firefighters union settled a 5-year contract calling for an 11% raise over the 5 years. The police contract was a little bit of a different story and a much more difficult road to get to a settlement. What happened on the police side was that the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, a gentleman by the name of Mike Shields, failed to notify the city of the FOP, the FOP represents the rank and file officers there, of the FOP's desire to reopen the contract. He missed. There's a 1-month period of time where he could send a notice in to reopen the contract, and the legal effect of that is that the contract rolled over. That all happened in 2012. And that meant that the contract rolled over, same terms and conditions of employment, no retroactive raise. That became a firestorm in Chicago. Shields lost in his attempt to hold on to his job as FOP president. There's a new FOP president now. The mayor, Rahm Emanuel, took a very aggressive position in bargaining, saying, look, you blew the reopener. There's no reason we have to give you that retroactivity unless you make some concessions. But now they've settled the contract, and the contract does include retroactivity. It's in the same wage settlement as the firefighters, 11% over 5 years. The cost of it is high. I mean, these are Chicago levels. The cost is $65 million. The vote in favor of it by the FOP membership was actually very high. It's a vote that's about 2/3, 1/3 in favor of the settlement. Pretty significantly, this is the first contract that has been settled without resort to binding arbitration in many, many years in Chicago. There's some other little things in the contract, probably not little if you're in Chicago, but in the scale of things, they don't compare to a $65 million payment. The cost of the retroactive raise is $65 million. So, for example, there's going to be a new copayment on the health care premium. It's only going to be for officers between the ages of 55 and 59, and it's going to be a copayment of 2%, and it's going to apply for post-retirement health insurance. There's also a clause that exempts police from a wellness plan that penalizes other city employees who don't participate. The bargaining got to the point of some serious discussions about new police vehicles. The Chicago runs its police vehicles very, very far into high mileage situations. The city, under the new contract, will have to buy 400 new police vehicles. So and there are other more minor provisions, but the basics for both police and fire in Chicago, 11% over 5 years. Now, what about Los Angeles? Los Angeles, we're in a situation where the firefighters have settled, but the police have not. The firefighter settlement, which was announced this summer, is a two-year contract, or as they call them in California, Memorandum of Understanding, calls for a wage freeze in the first year and 2% next year. Los Angeles, you may have heard, is facing a very significant budget problem, and the mayor of Los Angeles had vowed that he needed to get a wage freeze for the first year of the contract with all of the city's unions. Most of the unions had agreed to that. With this agreement, the firefighters will have gone along with the mayor's request in exchange for getting a 2% raise in the second year of the contract, which is something that was beyond what the mayor wanted to do. On the police side, news not quite so good. There was a tentative agreement that was reached between the rank and file union, it's called the Los Angeles Police Protective League, and the city of Los Angeles, and that tentative agreement was voted down by the Police Protective League's membership. And there's been a lot of public statements about that whole process of the contract being voted down, I think, safe to say there's a lot of, or at least was, a lot of anger over the issue. The mayor attempted to reach out directly to Police Protective League members to encourage them to basically accept his position. That, of course, in many states would be an unfair labor practice. It would be considered to be an end run. California's laws are a little bit different on that score. Not sure how that one is going to come out. And the long and short of it is, in Los Angeles, they're still at impasse. So that's where we are with our big three. New York, we have contracts that are 4 years expired. It doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon that would suggest an immediate settlement. In Chicago, we have contracts that are settled for police and fire, 11% over 5 years. In Los Angeles, we have the firefighters settled 2% over 2 years in the second of the 2 years of the contract, and police at impasse. While we're talking money, let's go over to Massachusetts and the settlement of a grievance involving the state troopers in Massachusetts and comp time. And it's kind of a fascinating issue, and it's interesting that it got resolved in this fashion. So here's what goes on. In 2005, the union that represents troopers in Massachusetts files a grievance and says, hey, you're violating the contract, and you're violating the contract because you're paying us straight time comp time. This is a grievance. This is not a Fair Labor Standards Act lawsuit. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, straight time comp time violates the law. Section 2070 of the FLSA makes it very, very clear that every hour of overtime worked has to be paid at the time and a half rate, if it's FLSA overtime worked, that is. So this is a grievance. It's not a lawsuit. Why are the troopers not filing a lawsuit under the FLSA? You can get much better remedies in federal court than you typically can through the grievance procedure. And the answer as to why they're not filing the lawsuit is a Supreme Court decision, a decision involving the state of Maine, where the Supreme Court, in one of these, 5-4 decisions you see all the time from the Supreme Court these days, in one of these 5-4 decisions in a labor relations case, where the Supreme Court says that state employees have no right to bring FLSA lawsuits against their employer. They're different than city employees and county employees, said the Supreme Court. They're shielded by what's called the 11th Amendment, or the employers, state employers are shielded by the 11th Amendment, which prohibits certain sort of lawsuits in federal court against state governments. And so state employees, said the court, and the case name is Alden versus Maine, state employees, unlike city and county employees, can't bring personal lawsuits under the FLSA. And that meant if the troopers are going to raise their rights, they're going to have to do it under the grievance procedure or under a state law. They're not going to be able to be filing an FLSA lawsuit. Now, what's interesting, the interesting twist on this is that the collective bargaining agreement itself seems to set the standards for the payment of overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And there's nothing wrong with that. A collective bargaining agreement can incorporate the provisions of the FLSA, either setting overtime thresholds or setting the rate at which overtime is paid, or in this case, setting the rules for the accrual of comp time. What has happened with this grievance is it just settled, and it settled for a lot of money. It settled for $21.5 million. The top five recipients of the state troopers union are going to receive payouts of $154,000, $121,000, $117,000, $114,000 and $112,000. The average payout to the 1,800 members of the union who will be dividing up the proceeds from this grievance, the average payout is $11,600. And of course, there'll be an agreement that the employer's practices will change and that there will be no such thing as straight time comp time anymore in the Massachusetts State Police. Let's go over to Ohio now and talk about an interesting court decision as to when an employer can unilaterally modify a contract. So let's say you've got a collective bargaining agreement that's in place. When is it that the employer can take some sort of action unilaterally to change the terms and conditions of the contract? In most states, the answer is never. You agree to a contract, that's it. You're done until the contract is expired. However, there are some states, and Ohio is one, and Florida is another, that allow employers to take unilateral action if they are facing dire conditions, dire financial conditions. And in Ohio, the phrase that you find in state law is whether or not the employer is facing exigent circumstances that would allow it to unilaterally implement contract changes. So what's this case all about? This involves the city of Toledo, Ohio, and it involves a police command officers union, the Toledo Police Command Officers Association, it's called. In 2009, they begin negotiating for a new contract, and at the time, Toledo is just being hit by the onset of the recession. There are a couple of clauses that are in the contract that are pretty important. One involves something called pension pickup. There's normally a 10% employee pension contribution in Ohio, but long ago, the association and the city had bargained that in lieu of a wage increase, the city would pay the employees 10% pension contribution. It's kind of a win-win sort of situation. The city gets the advantage of a kind of a lower base rate for purposes of overtime and other calculations, and employees get some, or at least we thought they got some tax advantages resulting from the pension pickup. So that's one of the two contract clauses that are at issue, and the other is health insurance. And the health insurance clause required the city to pay the full cost of health insurance premiums. In the 2009 negotiations, It seemed like every day was bringing worse news from the economy. Remember, Toledo, firmly situated in what's called the Rust Belt, very, very hard hit by the recession. And eventually, in 2009, the city and the association reach an agreement that calls for temporary cuts that will produce one-time only savings for the city. And those temporary cuts involve, for example, reducing the pension pickup from 10% to 3% for 15 pay periods, some medical co-payments and reductions in overtime and the like, and even the elimination of some positions. But all of those cuts were really, or almost all of those cuts, were temporary in nature. While this new agreement is in effect, the city's financial condition gets worse. And the city is now facing a deficit. Any deficit is illegal under Ohio law. The city is facing a deficit of $44 million. And the city goes to the association and says, we need more concessions from you. We need another $902,000 in concessions. The association says, nope, we've had enough in the area of concessions. If you want concessions, there's some things that we can do. You know, we can agree to a hiring freeze. We can defer some overtime payments to our members, just defer them, not eliminate them. But we're not going to agree to any long-term concessions. The city then unilaterally implements, saying it has exigent circumstances. And what it unilaterally implements is completely eliminating that 10% pension pickup, which means a 10% wage reduction for all association members, and requires association members to pay 20% of the total cost of health insurance premiums. And the issue the Ohio Court of Appeals has to address is, was the city in fact facing exigent circumstances? Does this $44 million deficit that the city was facing, does that amount to what's necessary to allow the city to unilaterally change the contract? And the Court of Appeals answers the question, no. And what the Court of Appeals focuses on is that for circumstances to be exigent, they have to involve conditions that weren't reasonably foreseeable at the time the contract was signed. In other words, exigent circumstances, say the court, or says the court, they have to be something that is new. And here, the city's financial problems weren't new. Let me read to you a couple of sentences from the court's opinion. While we recognize that the budget deficits were initially smaller and constantly escalating, the economic indicators that were before the city during negotiations for this modified agreement should have led the city to conclude that the deficit would balloon over time. The court refers to some tax revenue forecasts and says the city was well aware of the crippling national recession that hit Northwest Ohio particularly hard. What's the significance of this? The court says that what the city was facing in the $44 million budget deficit was predictable. It was reasonably foreseeable, and therefore, by definition, does not amount to exigent circumstances. So what's the remedy? The remedy, the court says, is you're going to have to undo the city's unilateral action. You're going to have to make employees whole for the 10% pension contribution, and you're going to have to make them whole for the co-payments on health insurance premiums. While we're talking about pensions, let's go on over to a case from a federal court of appeals. It's the 11th Circuit Federal Court of Appeals about whether or not employees have vested pension rights. This decision really isn't a very revolutionary decision from the standpoint of the law, but it's a good reminder of when employers have the ability to change benefits or contributions in a pension system and when they don't. This is a case that involved the city of Gadsden, Alabama, and Gadsden had a local retirement fund that started in 1939, but by 2002 there were enough problems with the local fund that the city and its employees, everybody agreed that they would terminate the local fund and move all the assets, liabilities, and members into what's known as the Employee Retirement System of Alabama. This is the state retirement system, and I'll refer to it as ERS. ERS has mandatory employee contributions, and those contributions have changed over time. They've ranged from 3.5% to 6%. So when the Gadsden firefighters move on over into the new plan, they're going to be charged whatever the employee contribution is. Well, it's not like the situation went from bad to worse, because it would have been hard to have been worse than the financial performance of the local plan, but ERS started having significant funding problems as well, and these were pre-recession funding problems. And the result was that the employer's contribution rate increases over the first decade of this century from 1.51% to 24.5%. Increases from 1.5% to 24.5%. You can see why they had financial problems if the employer's contribution was only 1.5%. At the same time, the city's sub-account in ERS goes from being 100% funded to only 58.2% funded. And that sort of financial malaise infects the entire ERS system. The legislature swings into action in 2011, makes a number of changes, and one of them is to increase the contribution rates paid by all Alabama state employees to ERS. And it increases that contribution from 6% to eventually 8.5%. This 2011 law gave cities and counties like Gadsden the opportunity to apply these state level increases to their own employees, and Gadsden did so. A group of firefighters then sues, saying that they have a vested right to a 6% contribution rate and that they could not be subject to this new 8.5% employee pension contribution. So, what does the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals do with this case? Well, the court starts off where all courts considering these pension cases start off. It starts off by saying, okay, what's the contract? Because this is a lawsuit under the so-called Contracts Clause of the United States and Alabama constitutions, and the Contracts Clause prohibits a public body, in this case it would be the city of Gadsden, from unilaterally modifying a contract to which it is a party. And the first question you have to ask is, what's the basis of the contract here? Who has vested contract rights? And what the court says in this case is, there's no contract that calls for a 6% retirement contribution by employees. And there's nothing that is certainly in writing between the city and the firefighters, and there's nothing even implicit in the way the state system works. So, for example, if you look at the PERS handbook, excuse me, the ERS handbook, you can find language that says that the amount of employee contribution is, and I'm quoting, subject to change by the Alabama legislature. And the court says, look, taken together, I'm quoting here, the evidence indicates that whatever contractual terms preside over the employment relationship between the city and its firefighters, a promise to refrain from raising contribution rates is not one of them. Now, that's the way courts look at these cases. And it could be in a different state, under a different system, you'd have a different result, where the employee contribution is fixed by the statute or is somehow memorialized either in a collective bargaining agreement or perhaps in an employer's ordinances. It could be you'd have a different result in that environment. But here in Alabama, the employer's contribution rate was explicitly variable, explicitly subject to change, and had in fact been changed many times over the years. And the court, I think, correctly reaches the conclusion there's no contract here that gives the employees a vested right to a specific contribution rate. Okay, moving away from money now, I want to go to a disciplinary case that involves a principle that's known as collateral estoppel. Now, when we get this stuff in law school, there were a couple of related principles that we were taught. One was collateral estoppel and the other was res judicata. And let me summarize both of those for you in about five words. No two bites at the apple. I guess I did six words now that I think about that. But the whole notion is if you've been given a shot to litigate an issue once and you lost, you're not going to be able to re-litigate the same issue. You see principles of collateral estoppel all over in the court system. It's a very collateral estoppel and res judicata, or as they're now called, claim preclusion and issue preclusion. You see them all over in the court system, and you see them in disciplinary cases. And so it was with a corrections lieutenant for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, a fellow named Michael LaPorta. LaPorta was subject to a drug test. He tested positive for methamphetamines, and he was terminated as a result. And the appeal system in California Corrections goes to what's known as a hearings board, and the hearings board is run by an administrative law judge. The hearing is scheduled in LaPorta's case. It turns out that the department needs a setover, needs a continuance. Why? Because the doctor who would have testified about the drug test results was unavailable. And the administrative law judge gets a little, I think it's safe to say, suspicious about all this. He calls the witness and the doctor said, I was only asked to attend this hearing at 10 o'clock the night before, and I've got patients. I can't get coverage for my patients. The judge, the administrative law judge, looks at the state and says, request for continuance denied. It's your fault. You should have notified this doctor long before 10 o'clock the night before the hearing. So the hearing goes on. And at the hearing, the department is only able to call one witness, LaPorta himself. Now, parenthetically, if we are in arbitration, the department may not have even been able to call LaPorta. There's a pretty big subgroup of arbitrators who think that the employer is not allowed to call the grievant as a witness in a disciplinary case, that it's kind of akin to, you know, the Fifth Amendment's prohibition on compulsory self-incrimination. And there's arbitrators going both ways on the issue, but there's a large group of arbitrators who will not let the employer do it. But this isn't arbitration. This is before a hearings board, and the department is able to call LaPorta as a witness. He denies using methamphetamine. That's the only evidence in the case. So how does the administrative law judge rule? He rules that the termination should be overturned. LaPorta goes back to work, and immediately the department fires him again. Why? This time because The department concludes that Laporta lied about his testimony at the hearing when he denied having used methamphetamines. And this time, the department does call the doctor. The doctor testifies about everything you'd expect, the chain of custody, testing procedure, and test results, and ends up concluding that Laporta's tests were positive for methamphetamine. In spite of this, and therefore, that would have meant, by the way, that Laporta lied in his testimony in the first hearing. And that's what the department's claim was. We're terminating not for drug use, but for untruthfulness. The administrative law judge says, nope, you can't do this. You can't have two bites at the apple. All you're really doing is trying a second time to establish the basic facts. And you're not going to be allowed to do it under principles of collateral estoppel. The California Court of Appeals upholds the administrative law judge's decision reversing the termination on the second time. And here's what the court ends up saying. At the second hearing, the second termination hearing, the department could not prove the dishonesty charge without again litigating the factual issue of the alleged drug use. This was the same allegation the department had litigated unsuccessfully in the first proceeding when it failed to produce its expert witness and presented only Laporta's testimony during its case in chief. The court ends up saying that, look, the first case was a decision on the merits. A judge, the administrative law judge, made a finding based on the evidence that the charge of drug use wasn't established. We're done. Collateral estoppel barred relitigation of the drug use issue, and without that evidence, there is no way the department can establish dishonesty. Now, I know this is an internal appeal system. It's a hearings board chaired by an administrative law judge. But actually, those of you who have binding arbitration, this is precisely the result that I would expect in binding arbitration. By the way, for those of you who are curious, because I didn't say it, what's the difference between collateral estoppel and res judicata? I'll bet it's only two or three of you who are curious about that. Collateral estoppel prohibits relitigation of an issue, a factual issue. Res judicata is actually a broader principle. It prohibits litigation of the entire claim rather than just simply an issue. There you go. The difference between collateral estoppel and res judicata. I want to turn now to a New Jersey case that I think is important for a couple of reasons. The first is something that is the court's holding itself, what is said in the case. And the second thing is what's not said in the case. This is a case involving the State Troopers Fraternal Organization of New Jersey, which is the union representing all New Jersey State Troopers below the rank of sergeant. The president is a fellow named Christopher Burgos, and Burgos represents members in labor negotiations and represents them through the internal disciplinary process. This all starts in January of 2013 when Burgos is notified that he himself is the target of an internal affairs investigation involving the alleged leak of a confidential document. What the department's investigatory arm, which is known as OPS, was alleging was that OPS had accidentally emailed an attorney, her name is Catherine Hartman, who represented some troopers in matters before OPS. And the accidental email included a copy of a report involving preliminary findings of an internal investigation involving a union member. Hartman, the lawyer, sends the email to Burgos. Hartman doesn't know that it is accidental. Sends it to Burgos, the president. And then Burgos turns and forwards the file to the attorneys for two troopers who were discussed in the report. At least that's what all the allegations are in this case. OPS finds out about all this, orders Burgos to submit to an interview or face potential discharge, saying OPS's allegations were, hey, that document was confidential. Burgos had no right to turn that over to anybody, and doing so involves a violation of a rule that prohibits the unauthorized release of information. The union then files a lawsuit in federal court and seeks what's called a temporary restraining order prohibiting the department from investigating Burgos. And the heart of the lawsuit, the heart of the claim, is that engaging in union activities is a First Amendment protected right. It's protected under what's known as the freedom of association. That's part and parcel of the freedom of speech that is laid out in the First Amendment. And that dispute gets all the way up to the Third Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And the court denies the request for a temporary restraining order. The court makes it very clear what it's deciding and what it's not deciding. The court is saying, look, we're not deciding here whether or not Burgos violated department policy. All we can decide is whether the First Amendment prohibits an investigation into an allegation that the policy was violated. Or as the court puts it, what matters for purposes of analyzing the TRO request or an injunction isn't whether Burgos's actions were actually unauthorized or even whether the document was confidential, but rather whether the department had some reasonable basis to believe those things and thus could investigate Burgos. And the court ends up saying that there's no First Amendment right that's implicated by, or at least implicated to the degree that we need to get involved in issuing a temporary restraining order. The court's holding is that, look, while Burgos argues that the union president's activities are privileged, protected by the First Amendment, the court says, but there's no constitutional right to associate for a purpose that's not protected by the First Amendment. And the court says the union cannot show that the internal investigation of Burgos infringes that right because there's no indication that that investigation has in any fashion significantly impacted the association's ability to engage in protected expressive activity or will have a chilling effect on it. The court also goes on to say that Burgos' status as a union president doesn't exempt him from compliance with state police rules and regulations. And the bottom line of the court's opinion is that Burgos may not be the most culpable person involved in the release of the document. That's probably the people who accidentally sent it to begin with. But the possibility that an investigation may be misguided doesn't make it violative of the First Amendment. So now, what's the significance of this case? Why do I say there's some importance in what the court says and there's some importance in what the court doesn't even discuss? First of all, in terms of what the court says, it's important to recognize that it is extremely difficult for a labor union to obtain a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction to stop an employer from doing something. Very often in the course of representing public safety labor organizations, I've had clients come to me and say, hey, we want to get a TRO. We want to stop them from imposing discipline, or we want to stop a particular contract violation. And my answer almost always has been that as long as there's some remedy under the law out there, a court won't get involved in issuing a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction. Rather, the court will say, look, you slug it out on the merits later. And whatever remedy is out there, so long as it's adequate, could be money damages, could be something else, could be an order, an eventual injunction prohibiting the employer from doing something. So long as that remedy is adequate, we're not going to step in at the TRO stage of the litigation. That's why, for example, unions are routinely unsuccessful in obtaining TROs prohibiting an employer from disciplining an employee. Courts figure the remedies that eventually will come out of an arbitration or a later court proceeding or civil service, those remedies will be adequate. They will make the employee whole. Therefore, we don't need to get involved at the onset of these proceedings on basically an emergency basis. And so when you see Burgess's case go up before the Federal Court of Appeals, you just know what's in the back of that. And that is, we're going to continue to make these TROs difficult to inviolate the Constitution and the First Amendment and freedom of association. Federal courts typically do not consider, they're not interested in, they don't have jurisdiction over state issues. And what state issue might be raised by this fact pattern? The question of whether Burgos is engaged in protected activity, or the issue of whether or not the state, by subjecting him with discipline, is improperly interfering with the internal representation rights of the association, or whether or not the state's actions amount to an attempt to intimidate the union because of the exercise of the union's protected rights. All of those things would be, if proven, in most states, unfair labor practices, or some states they're called prohibited practices, or the various terms are used, but I think it's safe to call them unfair labor practices. The federal court never gets into any of those issues because those aren't within its jurisdiction. That would be a matter in New Jersey for New Jersey's Public Employment Relations Commission and eventually the state court system. So the takeaway from this case, or the two takeaways from this case, are first of all, temporary restraining orders are exceedingly difficult to get. And secondly, it may be that a given fact pattern, this one in particular, raises not only federal rights that would end up being litigated in federal court, but also state rights that might be litigated in a state labor board setting or under state court. I want to wind up with just some projections that are out there, a couple of them that I think are pretty important from an economic standpoint. First of all, we're seeing all sorts of consumer price index projections coming in over the next 3 to 5 years, and the numbers look extremely moderate. The projections we're seeing from folks like the Congressional Budget Office are that the CPI will increase at a rate around 2%, give or take 0.2% in either direction. The other projections that we're seeing are projections as to where healthcare costs appear to be coming in for the year 2015. I think probably the most likely of those projections, or not most likely, but I think a pretty safe projection, is that health care costs will come in with an increase of about 7.5%. That's the number that Price Waterhouse gives, and Price Waterhouse has been pretty accurate in the past with respect to these projections. You can find numbers that are higher than lower than that. But I think if I was betting on this, I'd suggest somewhere around 7.5% would be a pretty good number. Well, that's it for our November 1st Thursday podcast. We hope to see you here in December, and have a good month. This is Will Aitchison signing off.